You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with the stories you need to know. ABC's London correspondent Geoffrey Kaufman is here with us. Geoffrey, what have you got?
Well, today the G20 begins in St. Petersburg. You've got to watch for that meeting between Obama and Putin.
Also on the program, Mali's new president, Ibrahim Keita, is sworn in. We'll look ahead to the issues and challenges confronting him.
Then we'll meet an author who's explored one of the world's most beautiful regions, the Alps, and their influence on the Nazis.
Fascinatingly, Switzerland being the only democracy and the only free land in Central Europe was a really great place to buy and exchange information. So Switzerland became the spying center for the whole West.
And in this week's edition of The Urbanist, we'll see what Mexico City is doing to shed its often unflattering image.
The boss of the Mexico City police decided to assign 3 police officers to each neighborhood in the city. And these officers have to go to every household and introduce themselves so as to reestablish trust between citizens and police.
All that, plus we'll check in with our man in Budapest. We'll review the European front pages and we'll play you some great music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy edition of Midori House coming up in the next 58 odd minutes.
But we're bright and perky.
Yes, we are. We always are here on Midori House. But before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
As world leaders head to St. Petersburg for the G20 summit, plans for American-led military action against Syria have cleared their first hurdle in Congress. A key Senate committee has backed President Obama's proposal for strikes in response to last month's apparent attack on civilians with chemical weapons. Both houses of Congress must still support the proposal, and there is significant opposition. But Democratic Congressman Jerry Connolly is backing military action.
We're not dealing with a president who's hungering to invade another country or put boots in the ground. In fact, quite obviously, his reluctance to do that is why we're here. There's no doubt the weapons exist, the stockpiles are there, and there's no doubt he used them. The question for us is, what do we do about it?
While the G20 summit is meant to focus on the global economy, rows over what to do about Syria could dominate. Before arriving in St. Petersburg, President Obama is due in Sweden, but protesters in Stockholm have their own message for him.
We don't like Obama to come here to Sweden because we see him as a war criminal.
It is peace, not war.
Obama wants Sweden to be a NATO member, and we are opposing all of that.
Meanwhile, 4 of Syria's neighbors, including Turkey and Iraq, have expressed their frustration and dismay at the international community's failure to take action to help the 2 million refugees who have fled the conflict in Syria so far. Chile's judiciary says it's seeking forgiveness from the country's people over its failure to protect them from military dictatorship. The body representing judges is apologizing for the failure to protect basic rights during Augusto Pinochet's rule in the 1970s and 80s. It's thought more than 3,000 people were killed under his rule. Kenya's parliament votes later on whether the country should become the first in the world to leave the International Criminal Court. The ICC says it won't stop the trials of Kenya's president and his deputy, who are both accused of crimes against humanity. Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto are both charged over the violence that followed disputed elections 6 years ago. There's been an alarming rise in the number of malaria cases in the southeast of Chad, according to health workers on the ground. Médecins Sans Frontières says there were 1,200 cases in the first week of August. By the end of the month, that had increased to more than 14,000. 1 in 4 deaths in Chad is due to malaria. At least 2 worshippers have been injured after 2 men raided a Shia mosque in Kabul. Police say the attackers, wearing Afghan police uniforms, were killed after a gun battle. Afghan officials say both came from Pakistan. They say the Taliban is still using safe havens in the country. 66 children needed medical treatment after a gas leak close to 2 schools in the Australian city of Brisbane. 6 were taken to hospital after the leak from a nearby business park. Kevin Walsh is from Queensland's Fire and Rescue Service.
It appears that there has been a release of a stenching agent, a type of agent that's used with natural gas to give it a distinctive smell. So obviously in the high concentrated release of a minor amount, that smell goes across the suburbs. And the good news is that there's no indication and there's no concerns for any type of serious medical condition.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. The time is just coming up to 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. The time is 10.06 in Istanbul. It's 9.06 in Geneva, 8.06 here in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the top three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Jeffrey Kaufman, Monocle regular contributor and ABC News' man here in London. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Of course, the wranglings continue up on Capitol Hill over in the States over whether or not to intervene.
You must be talking about Syria.
I think we might be.
I'm afraid Syria is on the agenda every day these days, isn't it? Obama, desperate to get this measure passed, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee did, in fact, vote a majority and a split majority, interestingly, Republicans and Democrats.
It was quite a close vote, wasn't it?
I think it was 10-7. But interestingly, we had Democrats and Republicans voting for and Democrats and Republicans voting against, which really shows that in highly partisan Washington, this is an issue that divides people differently. You have anti-war people and you have conservative skeptics, isolationists aligning themselves. And then you have sort of centrists from both parties getting together, and I guess the hawks as well from the Republicans.
A lot of the papers have been reporting that this small but significant victory that Obama experienced yesterday will give him great succor when it comes to actually getting the backing of the rest of Congress.
Yeah, it gives him momentum. I mean, obviously, every victory pushes you a step closer and every defeat pushes you in the opposite direction. I think actually on our agenda today, really, we have to turn our eyes to lovely St. Petersburg, Russia, where Obama will be landing shortly for a meeting of the G20. Talk about an interesting dynamic. Here you have Vladimir Putin sending out such mixed signals in the last 24 hours. You may remember that Obama actually canceled his one-on-one with Putin, in part because Putin's given shelter to Edward Snowden, what do I call him? The WikiLeaker? Is that what I call him?
Whistleblower.
The whistleblower. Thank you. That was the word I was looking for. Almost the same. So there we have Putin and Obama with the heads of 17 other countries plus the EU. And the agenda on the G20 for the G20 really has been mostly world finance, banking reform, hidden bank accounts, tax harmonization, things like that, trying to help poor countries collect taxes, all those things. But it's completely overshadowed today by Syria and what's going on. And it's going to be very hard to get much in terms of the financial issues, which are really important, but not nearly as, shall we say, exciting.
It's going to be an unusual dynamic because when you look at this, it doesn't seem to be a sort of a U.S.-Russia confrontation. This is a direct confrontation between Obama and Putin, two very, very different men. Obama, not necessarily a man who is very hawkish at all. He seems to be avoiding conflict as much as he can.
Well, yeah, Putin was so interesting yesterday. He gave an interview to the Associated Press in which at one point he accused John Kerry, the Secretary of State, of lying to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee by claiming that Kerry said al-Qaeda was not in Syria. And in fact, that is not correct. And the record shows that Kerry didn't make any statement like that. So Putin was misinformed. And then he later said in the interview, and I'm paraphrasing here, these are not the exact words, I'm not elected to please Obama and the American people, and Obama's not elected to please me and the Russian people, but we all have a common global interest in it. And so there was a bit of an olive branch there. I think there is a recognition, thankfully, from Putin that there is that they have to at some point find some harmony or the consequences are catastrophic. And he did even acknowledge that if they could prove there were chemical weapons used in Syria by Assad, that he would be in favor of some sort of military action.
And that's what he's been continuing to ask the American administration to do, is to show the evidence. But the Americans still haven't made that evidence public.
Well, they have made some evidence public. And, I don't know whether we're going to ever find a smoking gun. But I think that, the evidence, there's no disagreement now that chemical weapons were used. There's no disagreement that a large number of civilians, including women and children, were killed. The question of who was responsible for them, there's simply no evidence that it was anyone other than Assad. And if you want to find, the smoking gun or the trigger in his pocket, I'm not sure we'll ever find that. But as time passes, it becomes a bit of a diversion to say who else could have done it, or somebody else did it. For the rebels to have done it on themselves and to have gassed their own people seems quite a stretch. And there's not been a shred of evidence that happened. I mean, there is evidence that these were delivered by military hardware from Assad's army. So, I think we need to move to a degree beyond that. It's just a question of whether Putin really wants to acknowledge.
Well, the crisis in Syria is not technically on the agenda at the G20. Of course, it will be discussed in backroom dealing. So is there much hope then that something concrete is actually going to come out of this?
Well, I think we need to look at someone like Angela Merkel as a power broker, as a kind of just to see whether there's a way to someone to come in and mediate between the two sides. She is perhaps the most influential person who can speak to both sides, and to see if there's a way to get them to talk to each other about Syria. There's a very interesting theory floating around Washington that it's in the U.S. interest. It's a very cynical theory, and I want to preface by saying that it's in the U.S. interest not to see anyone win in Syria. That we have al-Qaeda and jihadist elements in the rebel on the rebel side, the rebel side, and we have Assad on the other side, and that there is no really good player. There are some rebel divisions that are not jihadist that the U.S. and others are supplying covertly, but they're not strong enough. And so there is a theory that by destabilizing Assad with military action, they're just going to allow this conflict to muddle on and muddle on. And, there'll be more casualties within Syria, but that way it will be contained within Syria. It's a very cynical view, but it is certainly one that has some currency.
I'm quite interested to see what Putin is going to do next, because some of the front pages in Europe this morning are saying that he is threatening to send a missile shield to protect the Syrians if action were to be undertaken by the Americans. Yet at the same time, if the UN chemical weapons inspectors do come back and say there is irrefutable evidence that there, not only were chemical weapons used, but it was the Assad regime that can do it.
But that's not
the UN won't do that. Just to correct you on that, the UN's sole role there is to say these were chemical weapons, and no one is disagreeing with that. We don't know specifically whether it was sarin gas, although it likely was. Now they're saying another week or two before we get the results. But they're not going to answer this. They're not the policemen of the world in that sense. They are meant to be an impartial body that says, here's what happened here. Here are the casualty numbers that we were able to ascertain. But they're really there specifically to say chemical weapons were used in violation, of world treaties.
Which is really why John Kerry and Barack Obama continue to hammer the point home that the UN is not going to tell us anything that we already don't know.
No, and I think the moral equation of this is an interesting one, because, it's interesting to see who's aligned up for it, for military action and against. This is not the same as so many of the other military adventures the U.S. and NATO have been involved in of late. I mean, this is a an international law. It is a clear international principle that chemical weapons will not be used. It's been on the books since 1925. And you know, there is an argument that says, if we don't stop it now, then what happens next time a crazed leader wants to use it and sees that there are no consequences? This is not simply more American imperialism. It's about chemical weapons. So I think the moral equation is quite different here, and I think sometimes that's being lost in some of the discussions.
Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you very much indeed for joining us as ever.
Coming up, we'll be asking what challenges confront Mali's new president as he's sworn in.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
Now, it's been less than 9 months since 4,000 French troops were deployed to Mali to rid the north of extremist rebels, while France contemplates military action once again in Syria. In an episode of almost breakneck speed, the people of Mali have seen a new president sworn in.
Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, or IBK, took over from the transitional leader Diakonde Touré on Wednesday. He says national reconciliation is a priority. Let's hear more now from James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. He's in the studio with us this morning. Welcome to the programme, James. Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, he's been in Mali's political scene for quite some time now. But give us a little bit more of a background and how he's come to be president.
So IBK is a mainstay of Mali's political elite. And exactly as you say, he's been at the very top of Malian politics for 20 years. He was prime minister for most of the 90s. He's been a finance minister. He's been Speaker of the House of Assembly. And he is firmly entrenched within the Malian political class. He managed to defeat other members of the political class in the most recent elections by, one, getting alliance with the army, two, getting the High Islamic Council to pretty much support him. But also he ran this campaign about restoring Mali's dignity and Mali's honour, which really resonated with the population.
And national reconciliation, as Emma said, is top of the agenda. IBK will have about 2 months to resume talks with the Tuaregs once he forms a government. What can we expect on that front?
Well, it's going to be difficult. So yesterday and the day before, the MNLA, which is the separatist Malian group, which is partly in control of Kidal, which is the most northern of the three northern regions in Mali, and it's the only one that is majority Tuareg, were trying to organise protests yesterday in Kidal against the inauguration. So he's got a difficult terrain to start with, but Mali has a long history of a cycle of Tuareg rebellion, bit of fighting, and then you get some kind of agreement where basically the elites within the Tuareg community get bought off in some manner, and then the cycle perpetuates. Then the other promises that are made to the rest of the population don't get fulfilled. This causes tension within the Tuareg community. Then there's some kind of movement and a bit of uprising within them, and then the Tuareg elite takes over that movement again. And there is this cycle. So there is a well-trodden path for how some kind of reconciliation will happen. The key demands are going to be things like increased development funding in the north, increased autonomy, and so on. But a lot of these that focus on purely state activities, so do we want a more federalized state system? Do we want state development funds to go in a particular way? Probably miss the point, because they assume that the problem has been a lack of independence for, or sorry, a lack of independence from central state government on the part of the Tuaregs. But when Mali is not a deeply centralized state, it's not a very strong state, it's not a highly developed state. So the idea that some kind of, you know, constitutional change and formal decentralization suddenly provides the things that are necessary, that doesn't work. I mean, a lot of the reason why there were problems in the north beforehand is that it was governed pretty indirectly under the previous president, Amadou Tamane Touré, and governed using local elites in these kind of non-state or outside of formal state structure networks. And this kind of helped corrode the state structure within the north, which is why when there was a coup and there was an uprising, things could fall so quickly.
There was a really interesting article in Le Monde this morning, which describes the fact that IBK is going to be effectively the recipient of several visits from several different parties, not parties, but several different groups in Mali. He's going to have the military knocking on his door saying, we want this, we want stability. He's going to say, as you say, he's going to have the Islamists knocking on their door, on his door. I mean, he wants to promote reconciliation. How capable do you think he is of doing so? Because so many groups want so many different things in this country.
Well, he's going to be able to bring together the vast majority of the population behind one thing. So if we exclude the Tuaregs, the majority of the population and the majority of the different groups in the population want national unity. And at the moment, he's going quite strong on saying we're going to bring or return proper national unity. And I think in his speech yesterday, he said we want everybody to be able to take part in the national symphony. And that kind of rhetoric will help keep the military on side and everybody else on side in his negotiations with the North, with the Tuareg separatists.
James, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, joining us here in the studio. Thanks very much.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, where the time here in London is 8:22 a.m. Now, the author Mark Twain described the Alps as the visible throne of God. It's a place of extreme drama, of incredible beauty and of peacefulness. It's been a draw for Europeans, at least for centuries, but of course it was a mountain residence of Hitler. Those familiar with the Alpine tourist train will be well aware of the coachloads of happy snappers who head to Gorpa, the Eagle's Nest, at Berchtesgaden on the Austrian-German border.
Hitler had a genuine love for Berchtesgaden. It's believed he directed much of the Second World War from his hideout there. Now, a book explores not just the Bavarian Alps, but the entire region in the context of its involvement in World War II. The author of the book, Jim Ring, joined us here at Midori House a little bit earlier and spoke to Monocle's Daphne Denny.
The fascinating thing about the Alps is that we have a very powerful image of them, this wonderful European mountain range. And if you go back to the first book that I wrote about the Alps, How the English Made the Alps, that covered the period from 1740 to 1940, you look back to people who really defined the Alps in the European imagination. People like John Ruskin, the great artist and writer, people like Leslie Stephen, and people like, even an American, Mark Twain. And Mark Twain wonderfully called the Alps the visible throne of God. John Ruskin described the range as the nearest thing we have in this earth to paradise. Leslie Stephen, who of course fathered Virginia Woolf and Vanessa Bell, he called the Alps in 1871 the playground of Europe. So we have this very powerful image of the Alps as an emblem of tranquility, peace and silence. And I think there's a tacit assumption amongst many people, even people who are familiar with the general waft and weave of the Second World War, that nothing happened in the Alps during the Second World War. The paradox is, of course, The truth is quite to the contrary. A great deal happened in the Alps during the war, and although many aspects of that had been picked up before, for example, thinking of your own background, the Alps and France as the cradle of the resistance, the story of the Swiss as the Nazis' bankers, none had been put together. This material had not been put together into a coherent narrative whole. And that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to redress that perception that nothing happened in the Alps, because a good deal did. And I wanted to fit together into an exciting narrative some very exciting material.
And it is quite interesting, isn't it? Because Switzerland obviously is still in everybody's imagination the neutral country by excellence, the one that we always think of as the one that didn't participate in wars. And there you tell us the story of Switzerland as a nest of spies, Switzerland the place where Hitler planned World War II. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, it's extraordinary. Again, many people think that Switzerland and the Alps are coextensive, and they get entirely about France and Liechtenstein and Austria and Bavaria, Yugoslavia, and indeed Italy. So we think that the Alps is Switzerland, and because we think that Switzerland was neutral, because we think correctly that Switzerland was neutral, as I say, we think that not a great deal happened. But in fact, a great deal happened in Switzerland in particular that is of particular interest. I think the story about the Swiss bankrolling the Nazis is, I'm afraid, that's a caricature, but the basis is clearly very accurate. Fascinatingly, Switzerland, of course, being the only democracy and the only free land in Central Europe, in effect, from 1940 onwards, when the occupation of France by the Germans occurred, was a really great place to buy and exchange information. So Switzerland became the spying centre for the whole West, and there was a great opportunity for British spies to learn about the Axis and its misdoings, and for Axis spies, Italians, but principally Germans, to learn lots of secrets about what the Allies were up to. So there is that story. On a more pleasing note, from the Swiss point of view, of course, there is the great work of the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is often forgotten, thinking once again of getting the balance about Switzerland absolutely correct. On the one hand, in August 1942, they decided to turn away Jewish refugees, those people who were fleeing the nascent Holocaust. The Holocaust had started, in effect, six months previously, following the Vannsee conference. On the other hand, if the state said no more, the individual citizens, many of them border guards, took things into their own hands and welcomed some of the Swiss refugees fleeing that. And that is a story that has been picked up in some of the other press and is a very wonderful one about border guards and other people close to the border who gave haven and refuge and succor to refugees, Jewish refugees, fleeing the Holocaust.
And you focus on a rather grim story as well in your book, which is obviously Hitler's relationship with the Alps, which is slightly fascinating, obviously, because you always want to be in the mind of this sort of the man who embodies evil. And it's interesting to look at what he found on that mountain. So can you tell us more about it?
Yes, it's a fascinating story, isn't it? We know of Hitler, of course, as the great warlord and one of the monstrous figures along with Stalin. But we also, in the back of our mind, know him as the failed artist, the failed watercolorist, the man who was rejected in Vienna when he wished to make the arts his career, and the man who genuinely fell in love with the Bavarian, the Bavarian Alps, and who settled in Berchtesgaden, who regarded really Berchtesgaden and the Bavarian Alps as his home. And in his own words, he conceived the European war, perhaps what he considered his war for world domination, in Berchtesgaden and in the Bavarian Alps. And in fact, although he directed some of the war from Berlin and some of the war from East Prussia and the Wolf's Lair, he directed much of it from Berchtesgaden. Why Berchtesgaden? He said, "It is no coincidence that I settled here." And he glanced at the Untersberg, which is one of the great peaks overlooking Berchtesgaden, and it is there, by rumour, that Frederick I was buried. Now, he was, you will remember, the medieval German Kaiser who first united Germany. And to use an English analogy, suppose I was, perish the thought, but suppose I was a latter-day Oliver Cromwell and I wanted to set up a republic. If I wanted to have a flattering halo, I might go and perch myself close to Camelot or close to the site of Camelot, where King Arthur, of course, is said to be buried. And there in the Untersberg, Barbarossa, Redbeard, as the Frederick I was known, was said to repose in an enchanted sleep, and he would rise again and unite the German people. So for Hitler, that choice of Berchtesgaden was a bit of reflected glory.
Jim Ring there, author of Storming the Eagle's Nest, Hitler's War in the Alps, speaking to Monocle's Daphne Denny.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Berlin.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of today's programme, we'll check in with our man in Budapest, we'll review the morning European front pages here in the studio, and we'll see what Mexico City is doing to shed its often unflattering image.
The boss of the Mexico City police decided to assign three police officers to each neighbourhood in the city, and these officers have to go to every household and introduce themselves so as to reestablish trust between citizens and police.
So a busy second half of the program coming up, but before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
A US Senate panel has approved military action against Syria, a key step in President Obama's campaign to get congressional approval for intervention. But both houses of Congress must still vote in favor of action over last month's apparent attack with chemical weapons. Meanwhile, four of Syria's neighbors have expressed frustration and dismay at the international failure to help 2 million refugees who fled Syria's civil war. Crisis in Syria is likely to overshadow the G20 summit of world leaders, which gets underway later today in the Russian city of St. Petersburg. The body representing judges in Chile has made an unprecedented apology for their failings during the country's military dictatorship. More than 3,000 people were killed during Augusto Pinochet's rule in the 1970s and 80s. The judiciary says it's seeking forgiveness for failing to stand up for basic rights. Kenya's parliament is to discuss withdrawing from the International Criminal Court. It will become the first country in the world to do so. The vote comes with the country's president and his deputy facing charges of crimes against humanity at the ICC. Health workers say there's been an alarming rise in the number of cases of malaria in the southeast of Chad. Médecins Sans Frontières says there were 1,200 cases in the first week of August, but by the end of the month that weekly rate had risen to more than 14,000. And the partners of gay members of the US military will in future be entitled to the same benefits as heterosexual couples. America's Attorney General Eric Holder announced that move after the Supreme Court overturned a law which had denied benefits to same-sex couples. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Paul will be back at the top of the hour to bring us a full roundup of today's news, after which point you can tune in to Robert Bound as he presents this week's episode of Culture. Stick around for that if you can. In the meantime, though, you're with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with Phil Hahn and Emma Nelson. Now let's turn our attention to this week's episode of The Urbanist, Monocle 24's programme devoted to the cities we live in. This week, The Urbanist asks what's to be done with Detroit, a city on the slide. They'll be seeking out advice from around the world on the simple things a city can do to draw in new residents and get the cash flowing again. In this preview, we're in Mexico City for some tips on combating crime.
Now, Detroit has one of the worst rates of violent crime amongst major cities in the United States, but the solution needn't be a cash-intensive pumping up of the police force. Once dubbed as one of the world's most dangerous cities, Mexico City has had to work hard to shed the rather unflattering title. Now, a dual focus on fighting crime and encouraging investment has helped transform the city.
Anne-Marie Weaver reports on some of the simpler things they've done, from book sharing to tax schemes.
Sirens ring out in Mexico City's Colonia Juarez neighborhood. Nowadays, it's a sound that you hear only occasionally, but a couple of decades ago, the sound of police sirens seemed to be the city's anthem. The capital was formerly one of the country's most dangerous cities. Now, it's one of the safest. And although this transition in status is partly due to the increase in drugs-related violence in the north of the country, Mexico City has undergone a dramatic transformation from the crime-ridden streets that once scattered the capital. Federal and local government realized that the city was in need of more than a superficial makeover. It also had to overcome the huge hurdle of international bad press after being dubbed the world's most polluted city by the World Health Organization in the early 90s. Yet, combating crime was first on the agenda, and rethinking police strategies was at the heart of this approach. Gabriel Tariba from the Mexican Institute of Competitiveness explains.
I think Mexico City has tried some interesting initiatives to reduce crime and also to increase civic participation in local decision-making. For instance, a few years ago, they changed the system of policing of surveillance of the city. The boss of the Mexico City Police decided to assign 3 police officers to each neighborhood in the city. And these officers have to go to every household and introduce themselves and leave a card with their phone number, so as to reestablish trust between citizens and police, which was practically non-existent in the city until fairly recently. And still today, most people will not trust the police. They see police more trouble than help in any given situation. But I think that was a good first step toward making society feel closer to police.
The stress on the importance of community engagement can also be seen in the city's community budget initiative. Neighborhoods can now take control of the trajectory of regeneration in their community by deciding the manner in which they spend a small sum of money given to them by the local government. In the south of the city, close to Metro General Anaya, a small children's playground sits facing a busy highway. The abundance of nearby traffic doesn't deter families enjoying an afternoon out at the park. In fact, according to one parent, the playground is just what the area needed.
Before the park was here, there were many trash sometimes, and there wasn't lights. Now it's very beautiful, and the children can play.
Reclaiming public spaces and transforming the fabric of an area that was once considered to be dangerous was a vital principle in Mexico City's regeneration process. The city's historic center is a classic case in point. A decade ago, it was a crime hotspot, notorious for muggings and assaults. To combat the problem, a group of some of the country's wealthiest investors turned abroad for help and hired former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, to provide a targeted response to the problem. His suggested reforms included preventing ad hoc street vendors from selling goods in the historic center. And although critics call Giuliani's response heavy-handed, the historic center is now one of the city's highlights. Recently, the government extended this strategy of reclaiming public spaces and embarked upon a plan to revamp the city's underpasses.
Sí, uno de guayaba.
Sí.
¿Cuánto vale? Disculpe.
Underneath Viaducto Tlalpan, shop owner Juan Rojas is busy attending to another customer. He's one of several small business owners located in the city's underpasses due to a government scheme that has transformed poorly lit underpass tunnels into spaces that encourage local enterprise.
Before this business was here, the place was abandoned and there were lots of robberies and it was really dirty here. So because of this, the government allowed businesses to rent this space so that the underpasses would be safer for everyone, especially for pedestrians, so they could pass by without any problems. I don't know about you, but I think it's a very good idea because people can now walk on by and there's no trouble, not like in the past.
Whilst the capital was at the cusp of transitioning into an economically productive and safe city, it simultaneously began to attract the interest of new business owners eager to tap into new opportunities. Umer Khan, co-owner of a bar called The Black Horse, cites the timing of opening the bar as a crucial element to its success.
Why was it easier to set up a bar in Mexico City as opposed to London? Basically because when we did set up the bar, which was about almost 10 years ago, first of all, there weren't many bars in Mexico City. You had a choice between restaurants, cantinas, and nightclubs, but there wasn't really a bar culture. Right now, there are, you know, bars everywhere. The philosophy behind the Black Horse is that all the partners share the same taste in music, which is basically a love for funk, jazz, hip-hop, rare groove. But the genres that I mentioned, it was very difficult to hear that kind of music. So we saw a gap in the market, and hence we opened up the bar.
And so a city in need of regeneration can also be a city abounding in opportunities. And it is this inexhaustible potential for new business development within cities on the brink of regeneration that ultimately may be the key to their future success. For Monocle, in Mexico City, I'm Anne-Marie Weaver.
And as always, you can catch this week's Urbanist, which focuses on advice for Detroit, tonight at 1900 hours London time. That's 1400 hours if you're listening to us from New York City.
But if you're listening now, you're with Midori House. We're back right after this with a check-in with our man in Budapest.
There's a touch of gold rush optimism on Fogo Island, the remote outpost off the coast of Newfoundland. Monocle Films journeyed to this idyll lost in time to witness reinvention at work.
Just living in that tangle with the North Atlantic breeds a kind of acute awareness of the natural, and I think it just makes you kind of quick and quick to a solution, quick to a response. And so that, I mean, you could call that entrepreneurial, but the ingenuity is all here. So really what we hope to do with our projects is just to kind of be the electric eel in the pond that helps with the connections.
Microloans meet macro ambitions on Fogo Island in the film section of monocle.com.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
It's 8:42 a.m. here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Time to check in with one of our correspondents to see what's making news in their little corner of the world.
And we're going to head over to Budapest, where it's 9:42 in the morning. Joining us there is Adam Labor. Adam, welcome to Midori House. Let's begin with some news when it comes to local by-elections over there in Hungary.
Yes, there's been a very interesting by-election here because all the polls show the government leading and on course to win the next election, probably in April 2014. But there's a by-election in a small town called Sziget-Szent Miklós, where the combined liberal-left opposition candidate completely trounced the government candidate and won by more than 20%. So that's sent real shockwaves through the political classes here.
How much of a surprise was it?
It was quite a surprise because it was held by the governing party, Fidesz, the centre-right sort of slash conservative party. And as they're leading in all the polls, it was a surprise. And so it makes people are starting to wonder if maybe these polls are not as accurate as they thought. And there could be a bigger surprise coming next April.
And of course, this is just one case of a by-election. But of course, the country will be heading to the election as a whole next year. And an interesting fact that many of the Hungarians who currently are living abroad could now, for the very first time, vote in those very elections.
Yes, I mean, the government, this is also very controversial. The government has made it very easy for the 5 million Hungarians who live in the neighboring countries like Slovakia and Serbia, Romania, Ukraine, to get Hungarian citizenship. Now, they can vote in the election next year, and they can vote by post. But native-born Hungarian citizens, you know, there's supposed to be 300,000 or 400,000 in Britain alone, for example, they're going to have to go to the embassy or the consulate. And the feeling is that most of the new Hungarian citizens will be very grateful for their citizenship, so they're more likely to vote for the government, and they could even swing it. So everything's really in a state of flux.
It is one of those moves that begs the question, how much of a political move is this by the incumbent party to encourage that they get enough backing? Because many of the people who are now going to be able to qualify for dual citizenship, they have origins which date back to the Austro-Hungarian Empire before World War One. I mean, this is very, very historical, isn't it?
Yes, it's very historical. What happened in 1920, after the end of the First World War, there was a treaty called Trianon, and the old Austro-Hungarian Empire was dismantled, and Hungary lost about two-thirds of its territory. So that left 5 million Hungarians outside the borders. And it's been a big question in Hungarian politics ever since then. And not just Hungarian politics, but also regional politics. I mean, if you're an ethnic Hungarian and you're living in Romania, I mean, I've met people in Romania who say that they're Hungarians, they don't speak Romanian, and they don't have any Romanian friends. And I say, but you're a Romanian citizen, you know, and they say, well, so what? I consider myself a Hungarian.
And Adam, it's not necessarily going to be a very smooth or easy ride for Prime Minister Orban. He has clashed previously with many people in his own country, civil rights groups, especially over claims that, you know, he's undermining democracy. How likely is it, do you think, that he indeed will win the next election?
My feeling is that they will probably win, but with a drastically reduced majority. At the moment, they have a two-thirds majority. I think they'll come in with a much smaller one. And if they do come in with a very small majority and it turns out that the election was indeed swung by these new citizens whom they've given citizenship, I think that will cause a huge furore here, that people will be very resentful that outsiders, as they see them, have suddenly got such a voice in domestic politics. Because remember, these people don't live here. They live abroad and they don't pay taxes here. So it's really an open question as to why they should have the vote.
Adam, let's move on to Jewish New Year. We have to wish Shana Tova to the many thousands of Hungarians who are experiencing Rosh Hashanah today.
Yes, today's Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year around the world, and the Jewish community here has had nice greetings from Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister, and the leader of the opposition parties. And one of the things that's happening here is, you know, often when you see Hungary in the news, you hear all the depressing stuff about the rise of the far right and the rise of anti-Semitism and racism against gypsies. But at the same time, there's a big revival in Jewish life here, and even in tiny small synagogues that only used to have, you know, just a handful of people go to them. A lot of young Jews are going there and rediscovering their heritage and being much more confident about everything than they were under communism. So, you know, it's a nice upbeat atmosphere here at the moment on that front.
Just describe the way that this resurgence is being done. There are these tiny little rooms, aren't they, that are now being set up?
Well, yes. I mean, one, there's a very old synagogue in a place called Telkiter, which is in the 7th district, a sort of quite parts of which are quite deprived part of Budapest. And it's a historic synagogue. And for years, you know, through the decades, it's managed to survive through the Nazi and the communist era. And now there's a group of young Jews are there and are really kind of reviving it and making it a very popular place to go, because there's also, you know, for example, there's the Great Synagogue on Dohan Street, but that holds 3,000 people. So it's very kind of formal and it's atmospheric and everything, but it's quite impersonal. And people are looking for a more kind of involved personal experience. So they're getting much more involved in the smaller synagogues.
OK, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed to Adam Labor, Monocle's man in Budapest.
It is 11 minutes until the top of the hour here in London. In a moment, we'll be reviewing this morning's European front pages with our Monocle researcher, Alexa Firmenich. But take us there is a Swiss song. This is Sophie Unger with Like, Like, Like.
No, I'm not supposed to look at you the way I look at you. I know I'm not supposed to look at you the way I look at you. Shades all day long and I sing it in a folk song too. I know I'm not supposed to wait for you the way I wait for you. I know I'm not supposed to wait for you the way I wait for you. So I pretend I'm on the go, I'd only meant to say hello to you.
mountain, I'll sing la 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 la. I'd like to see you. Supposed to know the truth. You're not supposed to show. No, you're not supposed to know the truth. 'Cause boy, I need your breeze more than I need your keys. I do. And I sing la 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 la.
And that was Like There by Sophie Unger.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Phil Hahn. Time to flip through some morning papers. Alexa Feminich is here in the studio to take a look at some of the European front pages. Alexa, lovely to see you. You wanted to start not with a front page, but with an announcement from WEF, which no one's really surprised about.
Yes, well, they've released their annual competitivity survey where they examine lots of all the countries around the world and rank them. I'm proud to say that Switzerland has come first.
Congratulations.
Thank you. For the fifth consecutive year on top of it. Apparently, we're very strong in pretty much all of the factors, innovation, education, research, infrastructure, etc.
Are we massively surprised about this? Because this is the fifth year running and, you know, their innovation is great. Their labour market is fantastic. And, you know, there's no one really who can actually honestly compete with them in terms of that, is there?
I mean, I think it'll be quite interesting to look at who comes second, third and fourth. So you have Singapore, Finland, Germany and the US. So I guess each of those countries have their own strengths and faults. But
it's good news for both Germany and the United States because they've obviously lost ground tremendously in the last few years, but are clearly clawing it back.
And of course, one of the areas where they were praised is, of course, when it comes to their banking sector. But this is in contrast to earlier this year when there were some, you know, quite strong reforms that people were asking, more transparency when it comes to their banking system in the country. I'm wondering what impact that potentially could have, not maybe for this year's index, but perhaps for next year.
Well, we've actually been praised in this year's index for quickly adapting to those changes and for really opening the talks and being transparent about the whole process.
There was one criticism, or there were several criticisms by the study, which said that especially in the agricultural market, the Swiss are incredibly protectionist. Now, this isn't just in agriculture, is it?
No.
This is a big problem that the Swiss need to get around, but it's also one of the reasons why they are so competitive. It's a real dichotomy they have to face.
Definitely. But actually, I'll move on to Le Monde, where on their front page, they're not as happy as the Swiss because they've moved down. They're 23rd in the classifications and they've lost 5 places over the past few years. So I think one of the major things I'll be tackling is a labour conflict. They have a very rigid labour environment and very bad relationships and conflicts between employers and employees.
And another issue which seems to be quite high on the agenda when it comes to France and competitiveness is education.
Yeah, well, actually, there's a huge, huge lack of teachers in France, so much so that they're actually stepping up a lot of sub-teachers and putting them in official teacher roles a large amount of teachers are under the age of 35, just under half of the entire teaching corps.
It is astonishing because it says that not only it's just been it's actually the financial crisis, but not that it's also the banking sector, mm-hmm. which has been the big problem for it, that they haven't been able to sort of recover and find themselves strong enough in the middle of the financial crisis.
You're an advantage because you can translate French and
it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm stuck with Alexa's notes.
At least you've got some notes.
That's true.
Which are brilliant.
Alexa, should we move on?
Philhan, you have just exploded the fourth wall that we've actually been briefed on this.
Should we
the idle
look
chit-chat of the Monocle studio has just been revealed as a fraud.
Should we have a look at Spain's El País?
Yeah, so actually, for those who don't know, they're releasing a film on the Pope. It'll be a co-production between a Spanish and Argentinian company.
Which Pope? The new one?
The new Pope.
Right,
the new
okay.
Pope. Pope Francis. And the actor is going to be, for those of you who know Motorcycle Diaries, Che Guevara's right-hand man. So Mr. Rodrigo de la Serna has been chosen. And the story will be told a combination of Spanish and Italian and will follow the life of the Pope.
When I think of South American drama, perhaps I get this wrong, but I don't necessarily find it to be an incredibly, I find it quite passionate and quite lively. Yes.
That's what Fernando Augusto Pacheco comes across.
Exactly. Yeah. And somehow trying to fit that image with a biography of the Pope, who is, you know, an incredibly humble and pious individual. I'm having problems with this. Plus the fact that, Phil, you've noticed that the lead is reasonably pleasant on the eye.
I think it'll be tricky. I mean, maybe one of the good things is that the director of the film, Alejandro Agresi, he already directed a film about a priest called Valentin. So I think he's going to be very conscious about being delicate and maybe not as dramatic as he would be for another film.
And speaking about being pious, plum pie.
Ooh.
Plum pie, what's this all about?
So plum pie, this is a tradition from my part of Switzerland, from the Canton of Genève, and it occurs on the Thursday following the first Sunday of September, and it's basically a day, and it's become a national holiday now, where everyone eats plum pie. And it used to actually be a day dedicated to prayer and an abstinence, because people believe that making the plum pie would leave women free to pray, and because it's seen as a frugal dish, you'd have your stomach free for meditation and more prayer.
Who would have thought plum pie was actually an example of abstinence?
I think when we think of pie, many people would think of American apple pie from that film, and obviously the pie was not used in a a very appropriate manner in that. Oh, well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for on today's program.
I can't believe you just said that.
thanks very much, Alexa Farmish, and thanks to our
Phil.
Producer, Danny Giacopelli, our researcher, Henrietta Landas, and Matt Alagaya, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, is Culture with Robert Bound.
Marcus, Hippy and Phil, we'll be back with more fun with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. I'm never eating apple pie or plum pie ever again. But from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Phil Hahn. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.